Welcome, everyone. You're tuning in to the Beyond the Pulse podcast, brought to you by the expert doctors at My Cardiologist, where we discuss a wide range of topics related to cardiovascular wellness and provide you with the knowledge, motivation, tips, and tools to help you make informed choices about your heart health. My Cardiologist is proud to be a leading provider of comprehensive cardiovascular care, serving the South Florida community for over 60 years. And we're thrilled to extend our care beyond the clinic through this podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, I am Dr. Celso de la Cruz. I am a non-invasive cardiologist who likes also to do preventive cardiology a lot. We are located, myself and my partners, in the Boca Raton office. And glad to be here to talk a little bit about lifestyle changes.
So lifestyle choices and heart health prevention starts with you is the topic of the podcast. Can you share some key lifestyle choices that significantly impact heart health?
So it's good you ask that, because recently both the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology want to emphasize a lot prevention. I mean, unfortunately, when we say cardiovascular diseases are the first cause globally of morbidity and mortality. Mm-hmm. So we have to do something different just to try to avoid to get to the established disease. Sure. So we're putting efforts in what is prevention. Mm-hmm. So especially American Heart Association has outlined 8 things that we have to work on in order to promote cardiovascular health. Mm-hmm. The 4 of them are more to treat established conditions that can lead you to established heart disease, which are high cholesterol, second is diabetes, the 3rd is high blood pressure, and the 4th is smoking cessation. But the other 4 are more things that we can do at home or we can modify in our own lifestyle, which are that our diet, the 2nd is how much we exercise, the 3rd is to watch our weight, to try to keep ourselves in our ideal weight all the time, and the last one, and actually was just added last year, is sleep. Before, maybe we have underestimated the magnitude or the potential of not sleeping the right amount of time in terms of preventing or maybe accelerating heart conditions, but given new data that came, the recommendation now, for example, for sleep is to have for adults, talking about older than 18 years old, more 7 and 9 hours of sleep daily.
Yeah. So can we deep dive into the sleep? So a lot of different professions don't get a lot of sleep, right? Are there what kind of impacts does not sleeping have on your heart?
So we have seen that sleeping outside this range or having days or sometimes, you know, that you don't have sometimes no sleep with time have some association with what we call cardiovascular events. And we are going to mention this word a lot in terms of cardiovascular events. But what cardiovascular events means basically is heart attack, stroke, and some of the times they can include there like an acute occlusion in the arteries of your legs or arms. But usually when we say, or when you hear in the studies, cardiovascular events, basically it's like a combination of those. Mm-hmm. So basically they have done some research trying to see the if there is any correlation between sleep and appearance or risk of having more cardiac events compared to people who sleep the correct amount of time. And they have found some correlation.
Sure.
It's just data suggesting it. We don't have like a big confirmatory study, like, you know, what we call, and you know, in COVID era, we heard a lot about randomized controlled trials, when we put people to do one thing and other people to do the other, and we watch them for a long time. Sure. There's no such kind of data yet, but the other kind of studies, when we look for associations, has been pretty robust in terms of conclusions of trying to sleep that good amount of time to have less chance to have those events.
Right. Okay, great. And the sleeping, if you can't get the sleep, the 7 hours, you know, we talk about different times a day that are better to sleep and to make sure you get good sleep, right? Mm-hmm. Can you classify, or what is your opinion on what good sleep is?
Usually we try to get at least 7 hours. I mean, of course, there's people who work the nighttime. There's mm-hmm. people that need to be more for, unfortunately, sometimes more than 12 or 16 hours shift. And besides work, you have to do other kinds of things. But as much as possible, trying to adhere to at least getting 7 hours of straight sleep, mm-hmm. either daytime or nighttime. There's no specific recommendation yet in terms of how to achieve it, but try to look the best way to try to get at least 7 hours mm-hmm. should be the goal for now. Okay. Of course, if when we get more data and we can get a little bit more specific, okay. we will be able to recommend like harder ways to do it, but at this time it's trying to get away to at least sleep 7 hours sure. consistently. Of course, there are days that you will need to, you know, work on something or something, but mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking more about like your usual amount of sleep rather than, you know, 1 or 2 days that for some reason you needed to spend sure. less more time working or something or doing something and you cannot sleep that
right
much.
So sometimes so they say 7 hours, but obviously some people may need 9 or some people may, you know, be okay at 6. Like if I were to sleep for 7 hours and I still feel tired, is that my body telling me that I need more sleep, or is that that I need 8 hours of sleep? So is there a direct correlation with maybe age or with how active you are as far as sleep?
Usually the recommendations are based on what is the average for population. Of course, every person is mm-hmm. different, but it's not a bad idea just to go to get checked if you see that consistently, even sleeping 9 hours is not working for you. Just to, you know, look out if there's any underlying sleep disorder, or is there any underlying sometimes, you know, mood disorders or some mental health diseases can impair your ability to have a good rest, or there's other kind of entities as well. So it's not a bad idea, because maybe at the end everything turns out right and maybe you just need more time, but at the end, is when you start seeing those signs, it's not a bad idea to get checked and see what's going on.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you. And you also mentioned diet being a big contributor to heart. Can we go into diet and kind of how you see diet playing a part, diet versus maybe medication, and how prevention, you know, diet can help prevent?
Yeah, so basically the big societies of cardiology have seen, after all the data that we have accumulated, that we have to do a lot of emphasis in diet and consistency in what a healthy diet is before considering, for example, pharmacologic treatments. Because at the end, you know, you can have a pill, but some of these pharmacologic agents that you take for a long time, and if you take it for a long time or more than needed, you can, all, you know, medications has always side effects. Of course, there are persons that will need it for sure, because, you know, every patient is different, but we have to be sure that at least we are working consistently on encouraging a healthy diet. And, you know, when people say, what's a healthy diet? So usually, if you want to make it simple, in a type, a lot of studies have seen that Mediterranean diet, you know, grains, fruits, vegetables, fish, and poultry such as chicken, even though Mediterranean doesn't have that much, are linked with better heart outcomes. Of course, on the other side, you know, processed red meats or sweetened beverages are linked with bad heart outcomes, and we have seen this consistently. Interestingly, Mediterranean diet effect, when we say cardiovascular events, in the biggest study, the protecting effect was driven more because of stroke, because it was more powerful, or, you know, the driving force was stroke prevention. Now, if you're telling me that I will avoid a stroke just by eating healthy, I will take it for sure. We have not seen such a big drive yet with heart, but when they turn a little bit more strict in terms of even not that much animal protein and more plant protein, they have seen that it's more consistent with less heart outcomes like heart attacks. But of course, you know, we are on the Western world and asking to adhere to a strict diet can be sometimes difficult. But I always try to tell my patients, you know, at least the best way is try to know your portions in terms of, you know, your calorie intake, because it's going to be easier to do that transition to a healthy diet. First, you know, what can you eat of each kind? And then slowly you're going to see, you know, okay, let's try to avoid more like red meats. Let's try to avoid more of all these things that make me bad. But being aware of how much calories you're consuming, being aware of how much of each group of food you can, is a good way to start. And one trick that I give to my patients sometimes is, you know better than I what you're eating. So why you don't put in your mind what you eat? And a good and easy way to start decreasing calories is think of all the carbohydrates you eat, like, you know, rice, potato, bread, tortilla, corn, unfortunately, counts as a carbohydrate as well. And try to half of it, switch it to vegetables, and you may see changes. Of course, this works sometimes, sometimes may not, but at least, you know, unfortunately, our diets consistently, especially here in South Florida, with a lot of Hispanic component, I have a lot of carbohydrate component. We love it, but, you know, unfortunately, we have seen that it's not linked with good heart results if we just eat our usual food.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of impacts does carbohydrates have on your heart?
So more is because if you eat more carbohydrates, it's more calories. And the calories, if you are not active, the more calories you use, the more calories that get stored, and that can lead to overweight. Also, excess of calories or excess of carbohydrates can turn into fat. And then we start going into the realm of high cholesterol. So it's like a cycle in terms of one thing triggering the other in terms of abnormal concentration of lipids, impairment in the metabolism of glucose that can lead later on diabetes. So that's kind of what's the impact in terms of heart disease of carbohydrates. I mean, the only thing is like the facts say that when you are between a body mass index between 18.5 and 24.9, it's linked with better heart results. Now, there are some different populations, for example, people who do physical tourism or do, you know, a lot of anaerobic weights and they want to be big for A, B, or C. On them, rather than BMI, we are looking at what's their fat content. So what's muscle and what's fat? And, you know, usually we have to be aware of that. And, you know, and fortunately with technology now, it's easier to monitor and you don't have to be on a center to do it. You can have an idea of how much is the fat under your skin, what we call the subcutaneous fat, or the fat inside your abdominal organs, which is called the visceral fat, which we have to be sure that are on normal ranges because especially the visceral fat is linked with poor cardiovascular outcomes when it's out of range. So yeah, I mean, data says that being on a normal BMI gives you an extra protection. And that's why we try to encourage people to try to be as close to their ideal weight as much as possible in the sense of we know that, and we have data backing up that can lead them to decrease the risk of having less heart or having a heart event or a cardiovascular event.
So you went into, you know, talking about weight and losing weight. Are there certain diets that you tend to think are better than others or to help people lose weight?
For now, as we were saying, Mediterranean, in theory, in terms has had the more consistent results. But each case is different. Each approach can be different. And I always like to say, and we like to promote always like dietitian on nutrition counseling. Because, you know, depends also on the people. You know, sometimes we are a little bit more eager in, you know, doing research and having a more strict knowledge of how much calories each food has, how much calories are we consuming. But some people need more guidance. And I think for that people, because sometimes, you know, when you see that you're not getting your goals, you get frustrated. So we don't want you to get frustrated. We just want to tell you, know, that it's good to try by your own, but there are also resources that you can use to try to get you there. And, you know, sometimes these people who are professional and elaborating diets and, you know, being conscious of how much calories they want you to lose over a certain period of time make things easier, and then you will learn along the way and then you can do it by your own.
Yeah, I'm going to shift a little bit more now to exercise, mm-hmm. and because I think exercise and weight kind of go hand in hand. What is your recommended amount of exercise per week, per day, to keep a healthy lifestyle?
So the recommendation is that we have at least 150 minutes a week of what we call moderate intensity exercise and 75 minutes a week of what we call vigorous exercise. Moderate intensity is, for example, walking on a treadmill at 4 miles per hour at least, swimming recreationally, biking like less than 10 miles per hour, or like slow biking. It's easier to see the speed of biking when you're on a stationary bike, but when you're a regular bike, just like going with a bike recreationally for at least that amount of time. And vigorous exercise is more like running or swimming, but in terms of, you know, going like back and forth in the pool, not just doing it recreationally. One example that the ACC and the AHA give is a single tennis match as a vigorous intensity exercise. And those are kind of the minimum a week. Now, if you want to do more, it's better. The more, the better. In terms of we have seen that there is correlation with less risk as more exercise you do. But now, usually we are really good friends in terms of cardiology with exercise and please be active. There are just few conditions like some, not all, but some patients who have heart failure or some rare entities where the patients are more predisposed to generate arrhythmias that we will limit exercise. But otherwise, we are always trying to encourage for the patients to be as active as possible. And the other topic on exercise is that the thing is trying to be active. It's not because that amount of time in a day is maybe 1 hour, 1 hour and a half. We are sleeping, let's say, 8. What are we doing the remainder 15 hours or so? So the advice is to try to not be as sedentary or as stationary as possible. You know, that's why the recommendation comes of, you know, outside of your exercise, try to do 10,000 steps a day. That's great in terms of being considered a little bit more active, because the more active you are, the more the heart will thank you at the end. Sure.
Yeah, and the Apple Watch.
And the
Apple
Watch.
Different things help you with that.
So, yeah, you know, a lot of devices that now can keep track of how much you're doing, and it's better because you have a better sense of how close to your goals you are and what you need to do extra in order to achieve if you are not there already.
Sure. And so when we are doing this exercise, is there a certain heart rate that we should be looking for, some beats per minute, or... Yeah, what are we trying to accomplish?
So in terms of heart rate, there's a lot of discrepant information in terms of where you need to be. Some people were saying before between 60 and 80% of the expected heart rate. And expected heart rate is usually something that can vary, is something that varies through age. But we don't have like a specific or concrete recommendation of where your heart rate should be. Of course, with vigorous exercise, your heart rate will be maybe close to the limit rather than with moderate, but there's no specific goal or zone that you have to be in order to get the most benefit or a zone you have to avoid will be at risk.
Okay, and that's benefit. That was my next question. If you do the vigorous exercise mm-hmm. for an extended period of time, is there a point where the exercise is not really beneficial and it's doing harm?
So unless there are some specific underlying conditions, we have not seen consistent evidence or signs pointing out that there is like a limit that we have to stop. So no, for now, unless, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, certain patients with heart failure or other conditions that are predisposed to arrhythmias, especially during exercise or in other types of abnormalities in the heart muscle, which fortunately are not that common, you don't need to push. There's no like a dangerous zone for you in theory. Of course, I always tell my patient, exercise, you know, have a good time. Don't torture yourself. You will get there. You will get there. But it's also time of patience, you know, because sometimes we want to get our best from day one that we started doing a training, but it takes time. I mean, the body needs to accommodate in order to be able to achieve a higher functional capacity.
When you are exercising, you usually do a warm up, you do, you know, the heavy lifting in the middle, and then you do the cool down. Does the cool down have an effect on your heart? Like, is it bad to just stop exercising, or is that more just for the overall body and getting you to a cooler state?
As far as I know, I don't think it has like a hard, harmful effect. But I think in terms of the dynamics of exercise, it's always better. I think it's more related, but don't quote me on this, but I think it's more like...
Opinion is great, yes.
More related to possible muscle injuries rather than a heart issue.
Perfect.
But again, don't quote me on this because I may be getting a little bit out of my territory.
No, that's great. I mean, And so as you're saying, you don't feel like it has any impact on your heart. If your heart goes from a heavy beating a lot per minute and then you just stop, it's not going to necessarily impact your heart. So that's good. So if we can shift a little bit now to, because I know this is part of health, heart health, is the smoking aspect. Mm-hmm. So obviously smoking is known as a high risk factor for heart disease. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give to those who are trying to quit smoking?
Don't give up. It's really hard sometimes to quit, especially when you're having smoking for a long period of time. Unfortunately, nicotine, your body gets used to the nicotine, and trying to do the nicotine withdrawal can be hard. Fortunately, Florida as a state have the tobacco-free line that can give support with nicotine replacement products, or also like a counseling, or, you know, like as a group. There are some, and there are other clinics that emphasize also sometimes pharmacologic management. But we recommend as cardiologists for all of us, not only cardiologists, to at least screen in every visit or address a smoking cessation or see what they are doing. I mean, because if they are ready to quit, it's the best time to try to offer resources, because we know and we have seen lately that the biggest or lifestyle change, or let's say the one that has more impact in reducing the most risk of adverse cardiovascular outcomes, is smoking cessation. Has more power than healthy diet, has more power than being active. So it's a big win when a patient stops smoking in terms of the risk. Now, they have to be consistent though, because in order to get to have a similar risk of a non-smoker, unfortunately it takes time, it takes years. Sometimes between 15 to 30 years of completely being out of smoking consistently in order to be in a similar level as a non-smoker. But yeah, I mean, unfortunately smoking is a bad poison, let's say, for the heart, for the arteries, and even taking the best medications or having the best procedures in order to, you know, be able to restore blood flow in any of the arteries, say in the heart or in other parts of the body, being smoking is like a big enemy to have.
And a lot of individuals choose to go to like vaping when they're trying to stop smoking. What's your perspective or thoughts on vaping and the impacts that they have on your heart?
When we started not knowing about vaping and they were saying that it was not as bad as the usual cigarette, we were skeptical. We were skeptical in terms, because we said, you know, it's similar products, but, you know, we studied, we follow it, and unfortunately, yes, even vaping is related to bad outcomes for the heart, especially in young people, especially in people younger than 45 years old. We have seen that they have risk to present with cardiac events if they are vaping. So unfortunately, it's not a safe alternative.
And you keep referencing cardiac events. For our viewers, can you kind of go into what a cardiac event may be, or what you classify?
Sure. Cardiac events basically is a heart attack. When we say cardiovascular event, we are saying more like the group of stroke and any acute occlusion or disease in the other arteries of the body outside of the heart. But yeah, usually sometimes we use this term interchangeably. So basically, you know, some studies designed just to look at heart outcomes. The other studies will look at the overall of the group of I just mentioned. So basically, that's what we refer to when we talk about that.
Yeah, great. Another big one in that we see a lot is stress management, right? Mm-hmm. And how stress plays a role on your heart.
Yes.
Can you go into, you know, it's often overlooked, right? People don't take that or don't consider it, oh, I'm not stressed, but maybe there is an impact. How does chronic stress affect the heart?
So, yeah, no, we have data suggesting that stress can lead to poor outcomes in terms of heart disease, or to present with more cardiac events. There's association of in studies that they have observed, and, you know, people who have stress and who don't have stress, and they have seen that these people tend to have more heart problems at the end. But yeah, especially the last guideline of the European Society of 2021 emphasizes in terms of screening and in terms of being aware that, and educate our patients that, you know, because some of our patients, unfortunately, say, you know, it's a stress. I deal with it all the time. I should be fine. But sometimes you can tell, especially during the visit, that maybe their coping skills are not the best. But it's worth it to, you know, try to recognize them and to suggest help in case you identify it. Because long term, we have seen that we have data suggesting that, yes, we can have worse cardiac outcomes if we just leave conditions like that untreated.
Mm-hmm. And so for jobs that are high stress, mm-hmm. right, like being a police officer, a fireman, yeah. Items like that, is there ways or that you recommend managing stress? You know, you say seeking help, right? Or a lot of people do yoga, or they, you know, are there ones that you lean towards, or is everybody individually different?
So what happened, fortunately, all options work somehow. There are studies looking, for example, meditation techniques that were helpful, behavioral therapy, medications for it. So fortunately, we have data suggesting that. Unfortunately, it's modest links only. It's not that as powerful as other kinds of intervention, let's say like smoking cessation, for example. But we see that when we recognize it and we intervene somehow to treat it, it's worth it. It's worth a try. And for high demand or high stress jobs, of course, I think you mentioned it good, and it's look for help. I mean, us know ourselves better than any other people. And if we start seeing that we are not able to function as good, or we're having struggles in going to go to our usual day, maybe that's the earliest sign that, hey, maybe things are a little bit out of control. And fortunately, compared to 20, 30 years ago, there's more resources and more ways in order to try to redirect or improve this kind of feelings. Because at the end, it's something that unfortunately accumulates little by little. And at the end, talking about especially the heart can have poor outcomes.
Sure. Yeah. And we're talking about lifestyle choices and heart health prevention. But what role does family history play in this heart disease? And how can individuals with a family history of heart issues take proactive steps?
So family history is good. It's good to know the family history. It's a key factor in order to establish what's your individual cardiovascular risk. One thing that we usually ask in clinic in order to see if there's something cooking in terms of family history is, for example, do you have any male relative, usually especially first degree, that have had a heart attack or a stroke, or you know, had a procedure to open one of the arteries of the legs earlier than 55? And the same question for women family members, but younger than 65. So that gives us an idea, okay, if that happened, maybe you are more prone to develop a heart disease earlier, and we should monitor you closely. Other things that we should know is if by A, B, or C, you know, especially if there has been some heart conditions in family members in their 20s, their 30s, or if there's like a generational heart disease, like I call it, like, you know, grandfather with something, the father with the same thing, and the son with the same thing, let's come to see us and get that checked out. Because, you know, we can just guide you if, you know, it's because, you know, as we said in, earlier, heart disease, unfortunately, is pretty common, but we can help you figure out if it happened because, you know, it's just because the environment or other issues, or if there's something in the family that you have to be aware of.
Sure. And when you have these family issues, when should we get checked?
So usually depends, because the recommendation is for everybody between 40 and 75 years old to have at least once a year have their cardiovascular risk factors checked. So meaning how your cholesterol is looking, have an idea of how your glucose or your hemoglobin A1C to see if how the glucose metabolism is, how your blood pressure is, and discuss, you know, about if you're smoking to quit smoking. And, you know, we have now an equation that can give us an idea if you are low, intermediate, high risk, but at least we have to have an idea of that annually for people between 40 and 75. For younger people between 20 and 39, can be every 3-4 years.
Mm-hmm. And so if you have a family history, though, should you go at a younger age, or is 40 to 70 still kind of the protocol?
If you have family history, I will say that maybe it's better to go like in your 30s. There's no like a specific guideline, because it depends what family history we're talking about. It's early disease of the arteries of the heart, if it's like a muscle disease that runs through the heart muscle disease, sorry, that runs through the family, is it an arrhythmia that runs through the family? So each of them have their own like specific ages where to seek care. But, you know, generally it's not a bad idea, at least before you're 40 years old, to have, hey, I just want to have an idea where I'm standing in terms of my risk factors for the heart.
Sure. And can you do that through your primary care, or do you have to go to a cardiologist to get something like that done?
Our friends from primary care has been usually helpful because, you know, especially usually actually they will get all that information through the usual labs, because, you know, the usual lab have a cholesterol panel, have like the glucose level. They take a blood pressure every visit. When they take the history, they know if they're smoking or not. But we are more than happy, you know, to, if there are some questions or some doubts or there's some concern, something not going on, take over and be able to have a better look to see what's the real risk at that time.
Are there any specific warning signs or symptoms people should be aware of that might be a sign of a heart problem?
So usually we have like five key symptoms that may be signs that something maybe is going on with the heart. The first, of course, the classic chest pain, chest pressure. It's one of the most known symptoms and one of the most known reasons that people come to the cardiologist.
And is that at one point in time or is that over time? So when you say the heart pressure is, if I feel it one day and then I don't feel it for another week, is that still considered a heart condition or it could be something else? Is it normally consistent?
So that typical chest pain of a heart condition is usually one that tends to progress or is usually present every time you do any kind of activity and starts getting more frequent. But it's not the only presentation. Sometimes can present in different ways, at rest or intermittently. So, you know, if there is a concern of chest pain, because it's true, especially in younger patients, heart is not the most common cause of chest pain, but there are other conditions such as, you know, chest wall etiology, or maybe is stomach related or esophagus related, or sometimes could be lung related, you know, sometimes about cough or inflammation of the lungs. Of course, that sometimes it's not something organic, sometimes can be psychological, but that's what we like to call the rule out. We have to rule out everything before calling something like that. But of course, if the etiology is not clear, we like to always help doing the workup in order to be sure that we have to be concerned or in other words, to be concerned about something related of the heart, or if we are able to identify something that can tell, hey, yeah, we have to do more workup because something is suspicious here, based on how you're presenting or your history or how your physical exam is.
Sure. Yeah. And you mentioned something during that about younger people don't typically have heart conditions, but obviously in the news, we've seen a lot of young athletes who are having some heart conditions or possibly dying. Yeah. And as a mother, right, I'm a mother, there's concerns. What can we do preventatively? What's your point of view on this? If you can talk, like, how can we prevent something like this in our young athlete happening, or are there steps that we can do to try to prevent this from happening?
Yeah, so young athletes is an interesting story, because there are some, especially the good thing is actually the school system is pretty good, especially in young athletes, to get checked, and at least they have an EKG, that's a good start. That's a good start to know what's going on. And of course, the encounter with the doctor who's doing the screening for the physical includes a family history, so they will try to elucidate if there's something going on, their past medical history. Also, of course, unfortunately, social history, we have to include their substance abuse starts sometimes early as in middle school. So we have to, you know, be aware of that and have a low threshold of suspicion if we consider that that can be something that's going on. Because it's really unfortunate when we have an episode, especially the worst, that is a sudden cardiac death, that maybe can be, you know, reanimated, unfortunately sometimes cannot. But I think that for now they are working on doing a better job in the screening, but for now always there's like the EKG, the physical exam, depending on the EKG findings, on other elements of the history, other kinds of testing can be included. But yeah, I think that there's job being done, because the community, especially our colleagues from sports medicine that we have certain fellows of cardiology doing sports medicine as well. They are the ones more interested to try to find and they're trying to find the best way in order to do this, in order to avoid any kind of those events happening.
So we kind of went through the importance you've retained, like regular checkups and whatnot. Is there, for a young person, is there a certain amount of time frame? Like, is it a yearly? Do I just go every 3 years? Do I go every 6 months? If I don't have any symptoms, but I have it in my family history, but I want to be preventative, right?
Oh, yeah. I think a yearly visit is more than enough. If there's nothing that has been identified, if there's no symptoms, once a year visit should be fine.
So after the age of 40, the recommendation is to have a regular checkup once a year.
Yeah.
Do you have any real life success stories in preventative health that you'd like to share?
No, yeah. I was working in Texas before joining my cardiologist. And the area of Texas I was working, we had, unfortunately, a lot of obesity. But no, yeah, I found people that, you know, giving some nutrition recommendations, explaining about the importance of, you know, a good diet, exercise, trying to keep the same weight, watch out his blood pressure, especially in the lifestyle. I had a couple of patients that were pretty grateful that because they said, you know, I never knew about this. I'm going to work. And a couple of them lost like 10, 20, 30 pounds. So they were happy because the other thing about happiness is that we have seen like an optimal mental health. It's not just that a bad mental health makes harm. The good thing is like a good mental health, it's convenient, gives us benefits or decreases risk by itself of heart outcomes. Because maybe the mechanism is not that clear, but what this has been more proposed is, you know, being happy, feeling optimistic, feeling grateful makes you more attentive to, let's say, medication adherence or lifestyle counseling adherence, and being on, how they say colloquially, being on top of your game. So, so that's good. And I was happy when I had those experiences back there in Texas.
Right. We always hear people say, oh, well, I don't eat too bad, right? Mm-hmm. Are there things that people can look for in the foods? You know, they're obviously reading the labels, but what are the triggers that they should stay away from?
Look for, if I always tell my patients, if you want to be more proactive, look at the labels that you're eating. And there's some things that you have to look for. Number one, if you have two same things and one have less calories than the other, try to go with the one that has less calories. When they break it down, they talk about in the labels about total carbohydrates and sugars. Try to avoid the one that has more sugars, because sugars are talking about small sugars molecules that actually are easily absorbed and do the most damage in terms of glucose metabolism and impaired glucose metabolism. So the less total calories, the less sugars. I mean, total carbohydrates, because, you know, we need carbohydrates. We need some sort of good cholesterol. We need our amount of proteins. We need a lot of nutrition components to have a healthy diet. But if you can decrease the total amount of calories, if you can decrease especially the total amount of sugars, and I will say also the amount of sodium, especially if you're dealing with blood pressure issues, those are good things to look. And of course, there's also total fat. The fat that we usually are a little bit more against is the ones that are called saturated fat or trans fats. So if you are able to compare and see those, the one that have the less, go for it. So in summary, I will say calories, sugars, saturated fats, and sodium component. So if you want to be a little more proactive in what you're looking at the grocery store, let's say.
Mm-hmm. So if there were any key takeaways that we want to leave with our listeners, mm-hmm. Just to generalize, you know, lifestyle choices and health, heart health prevention, what would we give them?
I think in summary, we will say if you want to work or be sure that your heart, your risk, sorry, for cardiovascular disease is the least as possible. Because I just want to stop and say, we even doing the best job, things happen sometimes. What I tell my patients is, I will be lying if I tell you doing this, you're not gonna have an event at all. But at least we can feel okay saying, hey, you know, I did all what I can do it possibly in order to try to keep things safe as possible and to try to keep my risk as low as possible. So I will say the 8 components that we were mentioning in the beginning, watch your diet, be active, do exercise, try to keep your weight as ideal, sleep your usual hours, and stop smoking, please. And do, take care of your cholesterol, take care of your diabetes if you have, take care of blood pressure. And working on those will make big changes in what is your risk for future events. And in terms of family history, if you are concerned or something, come to us and we can guide you to see if actually that is something that may enhance your risk of an event or not. And also in Mercariolo, we're aware that besides all those things that I was mentioning, there are also other things that we're on the lookout that can increase your risk for disease, like chronic kidney disease, autoimmune inflammatory conditions. We know, unfortunately, that Southeast Asians, more in terms of patients coming from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, just by ethnicity, have more risk. So there are other things that we have to be on the lookout, but when you are with us in a visit, we always try to be aware of all those risks. We want to be sure enough to tell you, hey, you know, after evaluating all of these, I think your risk is this, and we have to do A, B, or C in order to do an intervention. Or some of the times I like when I say, hey, you're doing everything great. Keep doing that way. So yeah, I think that will be the takeaway that I will say.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Leave you with how does my cardiologist team, you know, as a group, right, assist patients in making lifestyle changes for better heart health?
We are pretty aware of the cardiovascular risk factors, the traditional ones and non-traditional ones, and we always try to assess what's your risk. If you have any particular family history that will trigger us to, you know, do things differently, but every visit we are trying to just be sure that you are working on optimizing this. Entities that can increase your cardiovascular risk. And of course, we like to work on prevention. And if by A, B, or C, you have an established condition, we will do the treatment for that. But we agree that it's pretty important to, besides treating the established condition, trying to prevent as much as possible for one to appear.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. De La Cruz, for joining us today on the Lifestyle Choices in Heart Health Prevention.
Thank you.
Want to get checked with a cardiologist, visit mycardiologist.com. Want to see Dr. De La Cruz? He's in our Boca Raton office. You can see a full range of services and cardiologists on the website, so click below.
Thank you for tuning in, and make sure you hit subscribe if you haven't already. To learn more about My Cardiologist, please visit us at mycardiologist.com.